your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day, another great week in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Not such a great day, and I hope it will be a better week if you follow the stock market. The market was down as much as 1,000 points, beyond 1,000 points. It is coronavirus related. At the moment, it's down a little bit less. It's now down 790 points. Still a painful day for people who have 401ks or who care about the market at all, who care about the direction of the economy. Is this Bernie Sanders' secret weapon, by the way? We will get to that. We'll also be speaking with Gordon Chang about some of the realities about this coronavirus crisis and why it may be a gigantic geopolitical strike and something that changes the whole future of the Communist Party and of the Chinese regime. Gordon has said that he believes it's the most serious threat to that regime since Tiananmen Square. There's also a very serious threat to Harvey Weinstein, who's already announced he's appealing the verdict. He was found guilty of third-degree rape and a criminal sex act. He could be going to jail for up to 25 years. He probably won't get that much time. And what does it mean? Well, it means that this lurid and disgusting trial is over, and it means that clearly the kind of behavior in which he was engaged, it's always been criminal. But now it's prosecutable and convictable. We'll talk a little bit about the Weinstein verdict. We'll also talk about, of course, the change in the Democratic prospect for a presidential nominee. Is it really possible for Bernie to win? A lot of people on the left say absolutely not. I actually think they're right. I mean, I think President Trump is an extremely likely winner. And President Trump knows this, if Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee. But that doesn't mean that a Bernie nomination is good news for the Republican Party. I don't think it helps the Republican Party or helps the country if one of our major parties goes absolutely nuts. It's a disastrous thing. Let me mention to you two examples, and they're very prominent examples. One was the election of 1964, which was just this towering landslide. Lyndon Johnson won 45 states. He won 60% of the vote. It was a wipeout. The Democrats won close to three quarters of both the House and the Senate. I mean, it was a complete Republican wipeout. And what followed was a corrupt and disastrous and horrible term for Lyndon Johnson, who was a bad president, despite the fact that he's been glossed over by historians. And he ended up not being able to run for his own second term. He had inherited part of the first term from John Kennedy. So he was eligible and he was running and he was on the ballot in New Hampshire, and the administration fell apart and ended in a disaster. And part of it was that the Republicans had become so irrelevant, so out of it after the Barry Goldwater Revolution, that the normal balance in American politics wasn't operating. We didn't have a two-party system. It didn't work. And the same thing happened to a Republican president that happened to that Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson. His name was Richard Nixon. He won 49 states in 1972. 49 states. And within 2 years of that triumphal victory, he had resigned from office. And partially because, honestly, if one party goes nuts, the other party tends to suffer. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number. There's so much focus right now on Bernie Sanders, as if his nomination is all but inevitable because of his big sweeping victory in Nevada. And the numbers from Nevada suggest that Bernie ends up in terms of the delegates to be allotted. Bernie ends up with 47%. Joe Biden, 20%. These are delegates to the state convention. We'll choose the delegates to the national convention. Pete Buttigieg at 14%. And then Elizabeth Warren, 10%. Tom Steyer at 5%. Why does he bother? Why is he spending this money? He spent a lot of money in Nevada, more than anybody else. He spent more money than anybody else in New Hampshire. And it doesn't help. Amy Klobuchar, 4%. Mike Bloomberg wasn't on the ballot, which is part of the stupidity of him even competing in Nevada. The idea that this represents this growing national tide for Bernie Sanders, and man, the Democratic Party is moving in Bernie's direction. You could make that case, it seems to me, a little bit more convincingly if you actually saw a growth in the percentage of the Democratic votes that Bernie Sanders received. But you don't. Last time out, he lost the Democratic primary, the Democratic caucuses in Nevada, to Hillary Clinton, who we all know to have been a very, very weak, very flawed candidate who lost to Donald J. Trump. But Bernie lost the 2016 caucuses in Nevada to her. But it was close. It was 53% for Hillary, 47% for Bernie. Now, do you know something? 47% 4 years ago, 47% now. That does not indicate that there are new cadres of voters who are coming out of the mountains and coming out of their caves and crawling out from under rocks and coming in and walking on dry land out of the ocean. I know there's not any ocean in Nevada. But come on, it does not indicate that there are these invisible armies who are suddenly mobilized by the magic of Bernie's inspiring rhetoric. It's not there. And the idea that he is somehow lighting a fire that is burning across the United States, sorry, he didn't even get a majority in Nevada, where he was very well organized. He spent a lot of money. The one big advantage he has coming up is he has more money than any of his rivals. And there's a piece on the front page of the New York Times yesterday about a lot of Bernie's rivals running out of dough. Bernie has it. And it's not his own money. It's money that's been sent in by millions and millions of people. But the idea that he can get 26% in New Hampshire and he got about 24% of the votes in Iowa and now he got his 47%, same as last time in Nevada. How is he going to do in South Carolina? South Carolina is going to be very, very important. And then right after that is Super Tuesday, which nobody knows because it's Massachusetts and it's Tennessee and it's North Carolina and it's Texas and it's California. And it's choosing almost half the delegates will have been chosen by the time Super Tuesday is over. And then a week after Super Tuesday are more great big primaries in Michigan and in Idaho and across the country, Pennsylvania. This is all going to play itself out. And the question that a lot of Democrats are asking is, could he possibly, Bernie Sanders, win the election against Donald Trump? And part of that goes to his commitment to a series of very extreme positions that even the New York Times has seen fit to criticize. He was asked about some of those positions when he was on CNN. I was actually on 60 Minutes on CBS with Anderson Cooper, who also works for CNN. And Anderson Cooper asked him on 60 Minutes about the cost of his proposals. Bernie Sanders on 60 Minutes. The point that he was trying to make is that he'll find a way. And finding a way, however, requires such a tremendous increase in taxes that it simply would hand to President Trump and to Republicans everywhere the best possible illustration to people that you are going to be paying more to buy government that you don't need. I understand that when it comes to the middle class tax increase that Bernie has acknowledged he would have to make in order to pay for his Medicare for All, he says, oh, that would somehow be paid for because people would no longer have to pay for health care premiums. And here's the interchange with Anderson Cooper.
How much will that cost?
Obviously, those are expensive propositions, but we have done our best on issue after issue in paying for them.
Do you know how much, though? I mean, do you have a price tag for all of this?
We do. I mean, you know, and the price tag is it will be substantially less than letting the current system go. I think it's about $30 trillion.
That's just for Medicare for All.
Just Medicare for All, yes.
Do you have a price tag for all of these things?
No, I don't. You mentioned making public colleges and universities tuition-free and canceling all student debt. That's correct. That's what I want to do. We pay for that through a modest tax on Wall Street speculation.
But you say you don't know what the total price is, but you know how it's going to be paid for. How do you know it's going to be paid for if you don't know how much the price is?
Well, I can't rattle off to you every nickel and every dime, but we have accounted for it. You talked about Medicare for All. We have options out there.
This is outrageous. I mean, it's completely outrageous because it's pie in the sky that will never pass Congress, that can't be paid for. And frankly, any part of it that does pass Congress is going to tank our economy and make it harder for American people to get ahead. This is, and let me just give you an illustration of how outrageous it is. He's talking about the federal government mandating that all public universities offer free tuition. Well, there's just a private university, a very exclusive and selective private university that has offered free tuition. Not for everybody, but for everybody who comes from a family that earns $80,000 a year or less. What university is doing that? It's USC. Yeah, that school. Known in California by a lot of people like my wife and my brother who are Bruins, who are UCLA graduates. They look down on USC. They call it the University for Spoiled Children. That's what USC stands for, right? Because it's always been a very expensive school. Right now, you can look it up. A year at USC, on average, costs $77,000. That's what you pay. Now, right now, they're saying that for most Americans, because most Americans have household income below $80,000, there'll be free tuition if you get into USC, and they're not going to discriminate based upon your ability to pay. Now, are they doing that because they get a big chunk of change from Washington, D.C.? No, they're doing that because it's the right thing to do and because they can, because USC, like other private universities, has tons of money coming in contributions, and apparently they have some contributions that are coming in directly to close this particular gap with this program. And this is something that ought to be applauded and encouraged. It's the right thing to do. And you don't need the federal government paying for it. It's ridiculous that you feel that you have to have it. The story says, writes this way, the University of Southern California will phase in free tuition for undergraduate students from families with an annual income of $80,000 or less. That's what the president of the university, Carol L. Folt, announced at the end of last week. As part of the initiative, ownership of a home will not be counted in determining a student's financial need to attend the Los Angeles private college with 20,500 undergraduates. Tuition and living expenses are above $77,000, above $77,000 annually. The changes will be phased in, beginning with first-year students entering USC in the fall of this year. And then in the spring of 2021, USC said. The university also said it will increase undergraduate financial aid by more than $30 million annually. When fully implemented, the expansion will allow USC to provide stronger financial assistance to more than 4,000 students every year. Okay, that's very substantial. And you know what? There are tons of other private universities that could make that offer. So Bernie Sanders is talking about now having free tuition at public universities, and his idea is free tuition for everybody, including for families who could pay for it or could pay for part of it. And that's part of the whole appeal of Sandersism, is lots and lots and lots of free stuff. But that leads to lots and lots and lots of new taxes, which are going to be crushing on the economy and crushing to everybody. The New York Times, which it balances two different pieces saying that Bernie can win, with a serious piece looking at the tax policy of the various candidates and talking about the literally $6 trillion a year that Bernie's programs would cost. $6 trillion. That's $6,000 billion. It's an untold number of zeros. It is so much money that even Michael Bloomberg, I don't think, can imagine it. And how is that money supposed to be paid for? We will get to that. And it's very dangerous, frankly, for the country. And it's dangerous to try to woo people with this kind of deceptive rhetoric. Speaking of dangerous, the coronavirus is alarmed our markets, appallingly, because it's now spreading to South Korea, where a lot of the spread has been associated with one gigantic evangelical Christian church in South Korea. And it's also been spreading in Italy. And the Italian spread is very problematic because they haven't been able to identify a Chinese source. There are also new reports that the Russian propaganda machine, which is interfering in the U.S. election on behalf of Bernie Sanders. Yes, it is. Even Bernie has acknowledged it. He's been briefed on it. And it makes a lot more sense to believe that the Russians want Bernie to win than to believe that they want Trump to win again. But Bernie Sanders and the Russian connection now also suggesting that the U.S. and the CIA are behind the coronavirus. And they are spreading that around the world. There's also some evidence that some of that information may be coming from China itself, because, of course, it takes them off the hook on something that they cannot defend. What are the problems in Chinese society? What are the problems in Chinese government? And even more deeply, in Chinese culture that have contributed to the coronavirus? We will get to that. And what does the Harvey Weinstein conviction actually mean? Is it appropriate to rejoice at the undoing of this prime example of a hateful Hollywood hypocrite? And there's much more about pressure on various Democratic candidates to drop out and consolidate against Bernie Sanders. And there's been a key endorsement by a former candidate of one of the remaining candidates. Who made the endorsement? And will it have a profound impact? We will get to the very latest from the one, the only, Marianne Williamson, and much more coming up on The Medved Show.
Everybody loves him.
Michael Medved.
Michael Medved Show, as promised, we have Gordon G. Chang with us. Gordon is one of the leading experts about the Chinese system of government and economy and culture, and has been one of the more insightful and, in fact, prophetic writers about the coronavirus crisis. He is reachable on Twitter, and his new Twitter feed is fascinating, involving some back and forth that is very informative. It's at Gordon, at Gordon G. Chang, no period, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, first of all, the market absolutely tanked, and it started coming back a little bit, but it's the market's been hit very, very hard by the latest news about the spread of the coronavirus. I thought it was good news that apparently the spread had slowed down in China. First of all, do you think it's true that the spread had slowed down in China?
I don't think so, Michael, but I don't know. But we do know that Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has been exercising extraordinary efforts to suppress information in the last 2 weeks. So we see the numbers that show that the virus is subsiding in a number of locations, but I don't think that we can trust them. So the answer is, it's anyone's guess.
And is there any realistic explanation as to what is happening in Milan, in Italy, with this major outbreak there?
That is absolutely fascinating because, as the World Health Organization has said, there have been a number of outbreaks with no links to China. And that means that this virus is being transmitted in ways that we don't know. Beijing has done its best to prevent the World Health Organization from investigating in Wuhan. The WHO team just went to that city a few days ago, well after the outbreak. And so there's a lot that we have to learn. But we also are seeing some very surprising news about this virus. One of them is that the incubation period could be more than just 14 days, as everyone's been saying. It could very well be 27 days. And we're also learning that this virus lasts a long time in hot weather, and probably it can be transmitted outside of the body on hard surfaces. So there's a lot here that is frightening.
There was a piece, speaking that's frightening, it was utterly fascinating to me, by a professor at a major university in Japan. His name is Yizheng Lian, and he teaches about Chinese culture, language, and he writes that there are two aspects of Chinese society that he thinks contributed to this virus. One being a governmental tendency to basically crack down on anyone who transmitted bad news. And he talks about the history with the SARS virus back in the early years of this century. Do you believe that that is one of the factors contributing to the crisis we're facing?
Well, certainly, because for 3 weeks in December and 3 weeks in January, this virus spread throughout China, and the Communist Party did its best to suppress information. The first case was diagnosed December 8th. On the 31st, there was a small notice that the Communist Party issued, but it wasn't until January 20th, when Xi Jinping actually talked about this in public, that the regime started to do things which were effective. So we started to see quarantines and other measures. And that means, essentially, there was this long period where the virus spread and Chinese people couldn't take really measures to protect themselves.
And one of the other things that Yizheng Lian mentions is what are called Jinbu foods, which apparently are foods in Chinese culture that are supposed to help with your health and your sexual performance. And he writes, I've seen snakes and the penises of bulls or horses, great for men, the theory goes, on offer at restaurants in many cities in southern China. Bats, which are thought to be the original source of both the current coronavirus and the SARS virus, are said to be good for restoring eyesight, especially the animal's granular feces called sands of nocturnal shine, gallbladders and bile harvested from live bears are for treating jaundice, tiger bone for sexual performance, etc. He suggests that this is very, very much part of Chinese culture and profoundly dangerous. You have a reaction?
Well, it certainly is a part of Chinese culture, and it is dangerous, especially the eating of live animals. And some of the things that have not been mentioned are so much worse, can spread, for instance, meningitis and other serious diseases. Right now, Michael, we don't know how the coronavirus started. People talk about the wet market in Wuhan, which would be basically an extension of what the professor was writing. But also there are other theories, and the authoritative British medical journal, The Lancet, on January 24th, issued an article which showed that many of the initial cases had no connection with the wet market and the practices that you mentioned. And state media in China has actually, in the last 3 or 4 days, come out with some pieces that suggest that maybe that market is not the original source of the coronavirus. Again, there's so much that we don't know about how this started. And until we do, it's going to be difficult for virologists and others to be able to combat it.
Well, right now, speaking of combating it, the Russians have apparently been spreading conspiracy theories all around the world that the entire virus is a CIA biological weapon, or that also has been put forward by the Chinese government. Any reason to have suspicions there?
Yes. The Chinese government and the Communist Party from about February 5 have been spreading these rumors, basically saying the U.S. was responsible for this, or at least laying the groundwork for that. And it's been allowing those rumors to circulate in Chinese social media platforms. Many people think that the reason why Beijing is doing this is that it needs someone to blame. Many people believe that the coronavirus escaped from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which is a P4 biosafety lab 20 miles away from the wet market that people have talked about. And if that's indeed the case, Beijing probably, the Communist Party probably not going to survive this if that is indeed shown to be the case, because many people in China already believe it. So what they're trying to do is say, no, it was not the Wuhan Institute. It was really the Americans that caused the coronavirus. They spread it to China. And this has implications, of course, for our relations with Beijing. And, of course, it also shows the inherent hostility of the Communist Party towards America and, of course, towards foreigners.
Do you believe that this is a crisis, the most serious crisis the regime has faced since Tiananmen Square?
Yes, clearly, Michael, that's the case. And this is not over yet. Despite the statistics showing that the virus is subsiding in China, this is going to be a critical issue for the party, because when the virus does subside, people are going to start indulging in recriminations. And it's not just the people of China, but it's also senior regime leaders. With what's going on in Wuhan, there's been a conversation across social media in China that the virus is, of course, deadly, but what is more deadly is the Communist Party. And people have been talking about a need to change the form of the Chinese government. So this has become revolutionary in a sense. And that means for the Communist Party, this is existential.
It is so important to get your perspective. People can keep up with Gordon at Gordon G. Chang, at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. We will be right back with more from another part of the world. President Trump getting a hero's welcome in India. That and more coming up on The Medved Show. And while the Democrats are destroying one another, assaulting one another with particular viciousness and effectiveness, with a new debate coming up. Yep. Michael Bloomberg gets a do-over. They're having a debate Tuesday night, this right before the upcoming South Carolina primary on Saturday. And then 72 hours later, it's Super Tuesday for all the marbles in California and Massachusetts and Texas and North Carolina and all across the country. That's all coming up. With all of that going on, President Trump is in India, and Narendra Modi, who won a huge landslide for his initial election as prime minister and then won an even bigger landslide for his re-election, seems to be very popular in India. He helped to introduce President Trump to a wildly cheering crowd. He just spoke to a crowd of 110,000 people crammed into a cricket stadium. Yeah, cricket's popular over there. And this is in the Gujarat province, which Narendra Modi, the prime minister, once ruled. In fact, for 16 years he ruled it. And President Trump had this to say.
From this day on, India will always hold a very special place in our hearts. The life of Prime Minister Modi underscores the limitless promise of this great nation. He started out by his father's side as a chihuahua, a tea seller. When he was a young man, he worked at a cafeteria in this city. Stand up.
Yes, they like Prime Minister Modi, and they also gave a very raucous welcome to Trump. Look, this is campaign footage that is very likely to help President Trump. Right now, there's a new USA Today Ipsos poll, and they're trying to spin it to suggest the headline is USA Today Ipsos poll for voters, Bernie Sanders outranks other Democrats and Trump on values and empathy. And this is a very misleading poll. And part of the reason it's misleading is because it asks questions that basically go aside from the questions people are going to ask themselves when they vote. And that's been shown by exit poll after exit poll after exit poll. They say if character is on the ballot in November, the USA Today Ipsos poll conducted last week, Wednesday through Thursday, shows Sanders has a clear advantage over the incumbent president. In the survey, 40% said they admired Sanders' character, well above the 26% who said they admired Trump. I would submit that's because they don't know much about Sanders' character. Really, they don't. They don't know that his only child was born out of wedlock. Will this be an issue in the election? His only child is a guy named Levy, who ran for Congress, state legislature in Vermont, lost. And he was conceived during the time Bernie was living in a treehouse with his then girlfriend. And okay, he has other children who he says who are stepchildren with his wife, Jane. And the idea that I mention that because when they say they admire Senator Sanders, most people don't know anything about him. They don't know anything about his life, what he's done, what he's achieved, what he's built for himself. They know a great deal about Trump. And they certainly know all about President Trump's challenges and character flaws and this and that. And yet, it's meaningless when they say only 26% of the people say they admire Trump. Then why is it in poll after poll, people far more likely than that say that they approve of the job he's doing? And footage of things like this tour of India, which I'm sure the president will use in campaign ads, and why shouldn't he, will show that, yes, he does have his admirers in parts of the world. And we are about, one hopes, to put together a great new trade deal with India that would help India, would help the United States. It would be good for the West. It would be good to counteract the influence of China. And would be certainly a step forward for the economy. Speaking of which, let's go to Michael in Seattle. Michael, you're on the Medved Show.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
I've been listening to your show for about a year now, and I really appreciate all everything you've done.
Well, thank you.
What I wanted to ask about was about the coronavirus you mentioned with a friend Gordon. You talked how it was affecting 401ks and how it was tremendously making the market and the NASDAQ and the Dow Jones, all that go down. And I wanted to ask, would you think that now is a good time to invest in the markets, like in invest a lump sum into the 401k?
Michael, we not only share a first name, but we share a thought process. I was actually thinking about that when I saw the market this morning, because I do not believe that this coronavirus is going to end up being the end of the world. I don't think it should be the end of prosperity. It could be very serious. We should take all precautions. And I know public health officials in the United States and elsewhere have to be looking at it. But while I'm reluctant to give investment advice, I don't believe that this decline today represents the end of the bull market. And certainly I know that President Trump and his economic team, and that economic team, let's give it to them. They've enjoyed great success. I don't think they will allow it to be the end of the bull market. So one of the things that I've always been struck by is allegedly the founder of the whole Rothschild dynasty said that the way you get rich is never try to buy at the lowest or to sell at the highest. So with the market just taking close to 1,000-point loss today, is it, if you have some money that you want to invest long term, it might be an okay time. And but it's interesting the way you're thinking. And I do think that the other thing that would actually bide very well, Michael, I appreciate your call and thanks for the kind words about the show. Look, I don't think that the American people are going to end up voting for economic collapse. And I think that if it becomes clear that this is going to be a choice between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, then one of the things that should help economic conditions continue to move forward would be the virtual certainty that Trump is going to win. And part of that is just based on sheer numbers. The New York Times, can we all agree, New York Times profoundly anti-Trump. That's why he calls them the failing New York Times. But they write this about Bernieonomics, right? Studies by the Penn Wharton budget model of the University of Pennsylvania. Of course, President Trump went to the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Have found that the tax proposals from Mr. Sanders will most likely fall hundreds of billions or upwards of $1 trillion short of what the campaign claims they will raise over the course of a decade. Some economists question whether it is even possible for Mr. Sanders, in particular, to raise the tens of trillions of dollars his spending programs would require, largely through taxing corporations and the very rich. In other words, they'd have to tax middle-class people a lot more. What they're talking about? They estimate in the New York Times that Bernie's proposals, just the ones he's talked about so far, would cost $50 trillion, almost doubling our national budget of this greatest nation on God's green earth.